Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new The National Blast podcast with Keenan Skelly. Join Keenan and guests as they blast you to a place that is certainly not boring, yet still giving you highlights from areas in cyber where key policies and legislation are needed, exist, but aren't enforced, or no one is even talking about it. Knowledge is power, now more than ever. VArmor enables organizations to protect their data, digital assets, and themselves through a complete understanding of all applications and identities and the information relationships between them. Every application, every user, every data element. Learn more at VArmor.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the National Blast. I cannot even tell you how amazing this conversation is. It talks about all my favorite things. We get into Battlestar Galactica. We get into XR, VR, AR, all of that fun stuff. But this would not be possible without our amazing two guests. We have Suchi Pahi and Joel Charlotte, who are really pushing the boundaries on what security means and what privacy means in every single one of these kinds of realities. I'm going to give each of them a chance to introduce themselves, and then we're going to jump right in. Suchi, you want to tell me?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. I am a data privacy and cybersecurity lawyer. I've been in the security world for a little while as the privacy person or the lawyer who's bringing like cool tips and tricks to make a security person's life a lot easier. And I'm a very curious person. So I met Kavya Perlman several years ago, and she'd started talking to me about XR. And I was like, well, have you guys thought about the privacy around this? And we had a great conversation at DEF CON, and that started my journey into reading and really evaluating the XR world.
Amazing. Joel, what about you?
Yes, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. So my name's Joel Charlotte. I wear a couple different hats. I am the director of operations for a cybersecurity nonprofit just outside of DC called the CyberBytes Foundation. We focus on education, innovation, and outreach around cybersecurity, and really focus on a lot of the emerging technologies that are coming out. So 5G, AR, VR, quantum, you know, we've got all those technologies down here, and we use them to conduct research and go after, you know, and help solve problems. I wear a couple different hats at night, other than, you know, dad and husband and all those other cool titles. But I've got a couple companies I'm trying to get started and up and running, one that focuses on security for AR and VR, and then the other is more of a hardware kind of aspect of AR and VR technologies. So retired Marine officer, spent 20 years.
I'm not going to hold that against him, though. I'm trying. I'm trying not to, at least.
Except it's all good. So little friendly rivalry is all good, especially during football season. So, but yeah, I mean, it's, I tend to focus more like on the security side. I have a very, very different outlook on this just based on some work I did at the Naval Postgraduate School. And we can get into that. And I'm more than happy, and we'll talk hours and hours and hours on that. You know, very interested in those kinds of things and how we protect users, because the technology is so different that it requires a different approach.
All right, Joel, you're just about to blow my mind about all of the things in XR. Tell me more.
Oh, well, I was actually starting was sort of how I got introduced to it. So I was mentioning, you know, I'm a retired Marine officer, so I have that sort of background. And really, it wasn't even because I was a Marine officer, except for the fact that I went to Naval Postgraduate School, right? So when I was at NPS getting my master's degree, I had the opportunity to go work for a think tank in DOD, right? So the Chief of Naval Operations used to run a think tank called the Strategic Studies Group. Pretty cool organization where you'd get 12 senior officers. You'd get about 6 mid-grade. So the folks that were up there in Rhode Island at the Naval War College. And then they would come down and get the quote unquote young folks right down at Naval Postgraduate School. And so you were handpicked. You had to go through an interview, et cetera, all that great stuff. Made it through, got selected to go.
I'm actually super familiar with this because I was in the Homeland Security Strategic Studies group when it stood up. So it was the same thing for leaders within DHS. You had to be GS-14, GS-15 to get into it.
Nice. And
exactly the same thing. That's why I kind of laughed, because it's amazing that we've been able to take that concept from the military and now apply it to.
And now apply it. Yeah. And the cool part about this organization is it was almost no it was almost like no rules. I don't want to say no rules, but it was a lot. I mean, you wanted to go talk to Bill Gates about something when he was still running Microsoft. I mean, these guys had connections and you'd literally pick up the phone and okay, Bill's getting on the phone with us next week. And you're like, what? Really? Like, how'd you pull that one off? But so it was, you had access to so many cool people, but the CNO every year would give a topic, right? And so the year I went, this was in 2005 or 2006. And the year I went, he came down and met with everybody and said, okay, I want you to study, how do naval forces operate in cyberspace in 2030? Like, okay. Whoa. All right. Like,
that sounds cool.
Yeah, you're like, okay, it's 2005 or 2006. Like, we have no idea what 2030 is going to look like. And cyberspace was still just a word, right? It was just new. Nobody really knew how to kind of define it. So
wasn't it domain at that point either?
No, actually it was. So JP 313 had just come out and defined sort of, they had sort of defined it. And so DoD was still struggling with how they were going to actually operate within cyberspace and what it actually really meant. Right. Mm-hmm. So we looked around and said, nobody's really defining it. So we took on the task of defining it, but at the same time, we had to figure out how we were going to operate in it. Right. So those same quote unquote young guys, right. The six of us from NPS, we introduced a lot of very weird to the senior guys things, right. Like, so of this course. Thing called like called Second Life, right. So if you're familiar with Second Life, Linden Labs makes it. At the time, it was one of only maybe three or maybe four different environments where you could go in and, you know, very choppy, moving around, all this great stuff. I mean, still awesome. I loved it. We introduced it to the senior guys and actually had them, we had everybody build an avatar, right? So you've got these senior O6s, these captains and colonels and, you know, trying to like figure out how to maneuver avatars in this space. And it, that alone was fun. But then the idea was, okay, get them in there and start to think about how we could use that. So somebody had come up with the concept of developing these autonomous bots that could roam Second Life. Mm-hmm. And do various things, right? So whether it's collect intelligence or just sort of be present or whatever. And it never really went anywhere within the SSG. So the process they had was that, okay, you would present a topic and then the group had to buy in. Otherwise, it got shelved, right? Mm-hmm. So if enough people weren't interested in it and it just didn't have legs. So that project or that concept didn't really go anywhere, but I loved it. I thought it was a great idea. And so at the end of our time there, I went up to the deputy director and said, hey, can I take that research back or can I take this information back and write my thesis on it? So that's what I took it back to Naval Push Graduate School. Again, now it's 2006, 2007 timeframe. My thesis advisor had no idea what I was talking about, right? And so, but he was like, hey, do it, right? Like, go for it. And so, by the way, I highly recommend if you're writing a thesis to find thesis advisors who have no idea, like have a concept that's so totally out there.
It was really like a shake off. You were like,
this is a strategic move.
Look, I'm super smart and I'm smarter than you in ways that you haven't even thought about yet.
It was cool. It got to the point where any of my reviews were really grammatical because they were like, I gotta believe you, right? Like they're like back before there was even an I believe button, you know, they were kind of playing around, but they could really only do so much. But the idea was, you know, these immersive environments, and I there's a lot of research that came out of Stanford and like a Dr. BJ Fogg that's out there. And then there's Jeremy Bailenson, who's still very well known within the community of AR and VR. And, you know, a lot of their research, if you look at what they sort of do, they talk about the softer side, right? Like the psychology behind it, the sociology, the fact that social rules really don't differ, you know, between, and I don't call it the virtual world, by the way, I call it the physical versus, I mean, I don't call it the real versus the virtual. It's the physical versus the virtual, right? Because at the end of the day, and the example I typically give people is if you and I, you know, are looking at the color blue, right? And they're different shades, like, or maybe you're colorblind, right? Like you don't see blue, that's your reality. My reality is I see blue, or I may see a different kind of shade. So what is, like, you could get existential rather quickly here on what is blue.
All and I can
what
think about reality. Right now is one of my favorite TV shows, Battlestar Galactica. But when they did the initial kind of reboot after that, that was Caprica, where they're literally defining what this means, what exactly what you're talking about. What's the difference between a virtual world or a digital world and the real world, and how are the socioeconomic and political and all of these things different in a digital world than they are in the real world? And the answer is they're not, because right. frankly, once you get into that digital world, it's just a recreation of the same norms that you're used to, or the same extremes that you're used to, right?
So yeah, absolutely. And if you take that even maybe a step further and just say, look, once I'm in this virtual environment, right, what I perceive to be real. Yep. So if I can get the virtual environment to get me to perceive something, that's real to me. Yep. And real tends to get very personal fast in that sense, right? But at the end of the day,
but that's what makes it real.
But that's exactly what I agree. Exactly. That's what makes it real. And to your point about, you know, the social norms, none of that stuff changes. Right. And so, but what does change is you've entered a man-made environment. And if I made it, I can manipulate that environment. Yeah. Right. So the way I looked, what my thesis was really about was how to change the environment, whether it's an avatar or the actual environment around the avatar, to make it so that I can create one of the things was I can create an avatar that's so likable to you because I either know who you are or based on how you're acting in this virtual environment, I could make some inferences and create an avatar that's so likable to you that it's almost instantly trustworthy, yep. right? And then because it's trustworthy, I mean, there were a couple leaps here, right? Because it's trustworthy, I now have the ability to do information operations, right?
So 100%. This so is like social media taken to the next level.
Yeah,
because you're not just replicating, you know, somebody's tweets or how they feel about certain things. You're incorporating that into the creation of this person who is so close to the real person that it's almost impossible to tell the difference. It's definitely IO, 100%.
And if the three of us were standing in a virtual room together, I could appear different to you than I could to Suchi.
Absolutely.
Right? Because yep. it is a man-made environment. It's, I mean, and you say it's social media. I say it's social engineering to a whole new level, right? Because I really can get in there and do some just crazy things.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Like, and there's some of this has been, I'll say, tested, you know, I mean, there's some that a lot of this is still just sort of theory, but at the end of the day, where we are, I mean, you know, you talk about AR, you talk about VR, right? So augmented reality, mm-hmm. adding virtual information on top of the physical world. You have virtual reality where I've basically encompassed myself in a digital environment, right? I take it like John Smart, he wrote one of the pieces of research I used. His name was John Smart. He wrote the Metaverse Roadmap. And that in there defines and to this day, I haven't found a better definition of the Metaverse, but it consists of virtual world, augmented world. I can't remember what the top right quadrant one is. It's basically sensors or IoT at the end of the day. And then you have mirror worlds, right? So if you think about like Google Maps, right, where I can go into Google Maps and see a very accurate representation of the physical world, but I'm not in it if like in a virtual world, right? Yeah. So it's more outward facing.
Theoretically, and probably more than theoretically at this point in time, do that with a human.
I mean, where I started to see issues, well, and coming from the military side, I had a very specific bent to it, right? Like it was offensive for me. How can the military use this environment to go out and do things that the military needs to do, right? Like the national security structure needs to go do. But for every offense, there's a defense, right? And oh, by the way, if I can do this to somebody can potentially do it back to me, right? So I'm kind of drawing this it's a long drawn out story here, right? But really where we're getting to is the fact that as I looked at this, I'm like, look, whether it's a mirror world or it's a virtual world or it's augmented reality or the sensors from IoT, there are security vulnerabilities in all of it, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you can't do immersive environments without data. you need data. You need data to build the environment. You need data about the person, right? So typically the way I say that is, you know, a lot of these are, it's data about and for a person, the user, right? So I need to know where I'm looking. I need to know where I am. I need to know, you know, what I need drawn in the virtual environment. So it's all about the data.
And data. You need to know the perspective of the user so well that it actually seems real to them.
Yes, absolutely. So tons of, you know, so for me, you know, I mean, we talked a little bit ahead of time, like my day job, if you will, I run operations for a nonprofit called CyberBytes Foundation. We're just outside of DC. We focus on education, innovation, and outreach, but we're really on emerging technologies, right? So AR and VR is actually one of them and pretty cool. We have a grant with NIST to look into natural authentication methods for augmented reality. Nice. So we've partnered with XRSI. You may be familiar with Kavya and her group. So we've partnered with her and they're part of the grant and we're looking, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be a great grant. We're going to do some really cool things. My nighttime job, number one, you know, I have a company called IVEA Consulting and it's born out of the thesis work, right? So it's little known, like IVEA, kind of cool, like virtual ideas, but really where it came from was my thesis title. Really the idea there is, look, I know there are things that can be done and they may or may not have already been looked at and tried. Some three-letter agencies may have been looking at some of this stuff, right? It's really, now it's more the defensive side, right? So because now it's, I know what can happen. Now my interest is more in how do I protect users? And so on from IVEA Consulting's perspective, there's sort of three ways to look at immersive technologies or XR, right?
One, wait, Joel, I'm gonna stop you there, Joel. Hold on one second.
So I've got like so many things to add to. Go ahead.
we've jumped right into the security concern, but before
Let's
we get there, I want us to go back a little bit for folks who are listening who aren't as familiar as you and I are, or other people may be in the space. So here's what I'm thinking about. We talked about augmented reality, virtual reality.
Microsoft calls it mixed reality.
Mixed reality. Yeah. And actually, maybe that's the question for me to you. I've always seen them in this spectrum, the different realities. And in the end, all of them seem to be moving towards what I would call, what Microsoft calls them, the mixed reality. So I think what would be helpful for listeners is, what do you call virtual reality versus augmented reality versus what does mixed reality encompass for you? And I ask you that because you're the technologist, so.
Yeah, sure. Everybody's kind of got their own answer here, right? And I think where we are in the state of the industry is we're starting to settle on some terms. I think augmented reality is probably pretty well set. I think virtual reality is pretty well set. You get Microsoft and Apple who tend to like to do their own thing. And so they call it something else, right? So Microsoft calls it mixed reality. And then Apple, I think a while ago, there was a rumor they were going to call it synthetic reality, right? Like, I guess we'll find out when their glasses come out here soon. But the other caveat I'll put on this is I don't like reality is such a, I don't know. I don't like the word because to me, everything's real. You know, Keenan, you've given the let the cat out of the bag. We've already had some of these, you know, prep conversations here, but you know, what's real is an awesome conversation. So it's tough to add reality to the end of it. But at the end of the day, augmented reality is about putting digital information on top of the physical world. So the best known example probably to date is Google Glass. I actually have a pair. I don't consider myself a glass hole, but there.
Wait. No, we gotta dig into that just a little.
Hold on. Reasonable minds might differ. If you have a Google Glass, then you might just automatically
be a glass hole. Tell me about that. What is it like? Is it weird? Whatever, please.
So, you know, I mean, when I saw Google Glass, that's where I got the idea for the second company, right? Like, it's because AR, I truly believe this. I think AR in particular is going to fundamentally change our lives, right? Because we're talking about, like, VR is cool, but my issue with VR is that your vision is occluded. You're in this environment, right? You can't see anybody else. You can't see anything going on around you. we're social beings, right? Like humans are social beings. Like you put somebody in a VR space and you can replicate that by meeting somebody else in a virtual space, but you're not hanging out. You're not seeing sort of what's there, and you're kind of stuck to where you are, right? So if you think about different applications for VR, they tend to be educational. They tend to be entertainment because you can't get up and walk around. I can't go down the hall and see things.
Or they AR, military in use, which...
But even the military tends to go towards training, right? Like it's all about, hey, how do I replicate the environment? And it's a great tool for it, right? Because you can replicate an environment in VR. And if somebody like, you know, for example, I was a helicopter pilot. We've been in virtual reality for quite a long time.
That explains so much right now.
Like why I talk with my hands. Is that, so many is that the part? Yes. So, you know, so we've been flight simulators, right? Like I can't tell you a time I didn't use a flight simulator, right? And I mean, in all my time in the Marine Corps, I was always in flight simulators, right? Like, I mean, we'd go flying as well, but
I feel we got shafted in like EOD because we had no simulators. We actually had real weapons that
you had to go out and blow yourself up.
Yeah. And I feel like we should totally have that. By the way, NAV School EOD, take note, virtual bomb disposal. Please care.
There you go. Yeah. And that's a tough school I hear too. Anyway, yeah, that's also a whole nother topic.
Hey, I'm going to stop you here again. Hold on. Okay. Virtual reality. So if I'm a complete noob in the space, I'm going, all right, I'm sitting somewhere. I've got to have like a wired headset, maybe some wired gloves. There might be some other device that's somewhere else in my room that's also watching me. And that's my virtual reality experience. Mom's, you know, if I'm a teenager, mom's coming by with some cookies, but I have no idea because I've got this headset on and I'm looking at whatever was created within the app or software or whatever. So that's the virtual reality you're talking about, but you don't think that's going to be the main thing. You're really focused on augmented reality. And so in augmented reality, it's more than Pokemon Go, but how far does it get? Like, can I start manipulating things? Like, you know, what is the key example of augmented reality that you see? Now, is it really Google Glass? Because Google Glass is just creepy, right?
It's too bad that Google Glass got such a bad name. And you know, I mean, the backstory, I think you hear everybody sort of talking about it in the sense that, oh, it's a failure. It didn't do well. By the way, Google Glass is still out there. And, the version of Google Glass that was out was a beta, right? It was never meant to be a commercial product. Google wanted to get it out of the hands of developers to see what they could do. That's why, I mean, it was $1,500 a pair way back in 2013 or whenever, you know.
Okay, so, that's all fair, but what happened since then? Are people still selling it or what?
Oh yeah, it's huge in the enterprise. You can go to Google, you can Google Google Glass right now, and you'll see that, you know, enterprises are using it. Right now, outside of the game, you know, Suchi, you mentioned Pokemon Go. That's great. It's a game. And the folks that are building AR games and even VR games, you know, they're great. They're helping drive the industry, right? Like that's how you get mass adoption is you get the games. That's one of the ways you get mass adoption, right? As that mass adoption comes out, you get the folks who are going to go, hey, you know what else we could use this for? This is, you know, like, hey, we could do this, we could do that. And you're starting to see that now. So, you know, Keenan, you mentioned the military. AR, I think, is going to have a huge role in the military. Yeah. Why? Yeah. I mean, well, look at HoloLens, right? Like look at the IBIS program, right? Like again, Microsoft calls it mixed reality, but really you're overlaying digital information on top of the physical world. So you've now got a heads up display for a soldier on the ground, right?
Even beyond that, when we start talking about, you know, the cyber force and what they can see and what they can do, if you have an infantryman or a scout that's going out and they are able to feed all of this data about the IPs and cyber and all of the fun stuff.
Or the electromagnetic spectrum, right?
Exactly.
And what that looks
that
like.
That changes warfare at a fundamental level, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think to sort of close that out though, right? Like, I mean, it's augmented reality is overlaying digital information on top of the physical world. And so, you know, right now what the general public is probably going to most recognize is Pokemon Go, right? Like you've got the creatures running around and you go find them. Like Niantic actually had games out prior to that, where you could see different portals and you could walk around, right? So, but Pokemon being Pokemon, it gathered more attention than than the other one that they had out. But really, you know, if you think about a heads-up display in a car, so there's a couple car manufacturers out there right now.
Yeah,
I think Mercedes has it. I think Kia even has a model that's got it, right? Like, so, and what you're doing is they're doing crosswalk detection. They're doing all these other different things where they can then highlight crosswalks. And
they can say, okay, legit, there's an old lady with a shopping cart and you do not need to kill her. So just don't.
That's right. So please don't. Stay away. So, I mean, and one of the things I'm working on is I'm working on building an app for low vision people to help them cross the street using augmented reality, right? So there's a different sort of approach to how you could use it other than gaming. But really the other place you're really going to see it, I think, really take off is in that enterprise space, right? Think about a factory floor. Think about something where if I could put directions on how to fix a device, or, hey, here's the manufacturing process, right? Like this widget goes on top of that widget and you turn it, right? Like you can do step-by-step directions. You can see part numbers. You can take things apart. Like, you know, so the mixed reality.
Actually going a little bit further than that. I mean, manufacturing is great, but how useful is this in medical, right?
Oh, yeah.
And for doctors who are doing a procedure and it doesn't look exactly like it's supposed to look, and oh, okay, well, let's mm-hmm. scroll through the options that are here and be able to augment that reality so that they can try to get it back to the place it's supposed to be, right?
So you're rolling right into the space that Microsoft has successfully been working in over the last several years with I think they call it HoloLens.
Yep.
I think there are several more folks in the enterprise also working in the space, but it's interesting because y'all are both focusing on like the real added benefits that we can have from augmented reality or mixed reality and all of that. Whereas as a privacy lawyer, when I'm listening to it, it's going, okay, I'm thinking about the state of the US's privacy regulations, which are sectoral, state by state, driving privacy lawyers insane on the daily. And we don't have state by state cybersecurity rules where they're sectoral as well, mostly regulating insurances. Yeah. So then you have these really cool technologies that are gathering so much data at such a small level, you know, second, millisecond by millisecond. And as the privacy lawyer, I'm going, well, I'm pretty sure enough of this data could figure out if someone has a health condition. And that data is sitting within a private device or mm-hmm. software person's hands. That's not regulated. Yeah.
Well, honestly, I didn't even go there. That wasn't even like on my radar of what we were going to talk about, but that's so true.
When I started digging into the research papers that are out there, and full disclosure, my background's in neurobiology. So I really like to read actual like peer-reviewed journals about this stuff, even if it's far outside of that field. And there are so many amazing things that people have figured out. Like you can figure out the state of a person's health from like breathing patterns. And granted, it's been done on a small population and it was like a particular cell phone style or mic style and stuff like that. But to have the results that they had, and then to imagine on such a large scale, what can be collected from a person who just wants to hang out or is being trained for their company or is, doing some kind of like educational environment exercise, like the amount of data on that one person that may not be regulated.
Now let's look at all of that data in the world that we live in today, where breaches are the norm, where access to data, unauthorized access to data is the norm. So how do we look at something like this that's collecting all of this data that can be damaging, that can be horrifying, that can ruin a person's life? And how do we look at that and say, every single day, we're seeing more and more breaches where things like this are just out there. Every day, we're seeing things on the dark net where we see more about human beings, about a person than we ever, ever, ever have before. What do we do with that?
I think that's the million-dollar question. And as security professionals, y'all will call any security breach a breach. As a lawyer, it has to be a specific type of data that's regulated before we'll call it a breach. Until then, it's an incident or something like that. And it is not relevant, which means that the end user isn't protected. But even beyond that, if you're in the US, you also have to look at what can law enforcement do with data that they wouldn't otherwise have access to before. And we have major gaps in protection for data around that as well. There's like hundreds of papers criticizing Fourth Amendment protections, the way they've been interpreted by the court, by the Supreme Court, when I say that. And, you know, it's like, yeah, we have a right to privacy, but it's not actually really well protected.
And it's not well enforced, right? It's all about the teeth. You know, we talk about legislation a lot on this podcast specifically, and I'm a proponent for legislation that makes sense, but also that has teeth and has an enforcement arm. You can't just broadly say that we're going to do this in the US without giving some agency the authority to act on that very thing. And I think this is one of those spaces, right? Where people talk about conceptually what they think should happen with XR, VR, AR, but there's no teeth, there's no organization, there's no government arm that is like, this is our thing, we have to fix this, right?
Yeah, and you know, and without derailing that, because this is an interesting conversation, right? And again, I've been, because of what I think we can do, you know, I mentioned earlier, for every offense, there's a defense, right? And so we have to be cognizant of the information that we're collecting and how we maintain. And like, you know, it's, you know, the same concepts that apply, I mean, the cybersecurity concepts, right? Least privilege and all those other kinds of things, they still apply to the data, right? Like, if you think about it, yeah, I can collect eye gaze data, but why? All right. Like if I need it,
well,
that's
we should ask Facebook and Instagram that.
Yeah, maybe that would be a very interesting conversation. I think that is the conversation.
But it's relevant.
Right now, right?
It is the conversation.
It is the conversation.
It is. It's not externally enforced at all. Right, Joel, like you can raise the conversation while I can sit on the corporate governance board within my company and go, we should think about this. But if everyone doesn't agree and start an implementation plan, there's also no accountability. So I mean, like,
and the bigger part of it is that companies don't want to do that. That costs money.
Right. And it either costs money on the front end to implement it, or it costs money on the back end because they lose some sort of functionality, right, in the product. So one, the three of us are not going to solve this problem, you know, on this podcast, right? But it's a great set of topics or conversations, because the other thing I want to throw out there is, you know, think about, I talked about building an app for low vision people, right? So what happens, who's right trumps the other person's right in that scenario. If I am building an app that actually has a public safety, you know, implementation to it, so I'm helping a low vision person safely cross the street, or I'm helping them avoid potholes. But in order to do that, I have to have
your burden is exponential. You have to have, you know, people from low visibility, you know, societies come in and say, this makes sense. And here's the technology that makes sense. And here's why it makes sense, because it addresses this issue. And then you need lawyers to say, okay, we have run this through every possible algorithm to say that there's no way that this can be faulty. And if there is a way that it's faulty, here's how, and here's what we're going to do about that. But all of those procedures and processes are just the beginning of making something like that work, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. And my only point in bringing that up is, if I'm developing an app to do those things, my camera has to be on. And so how do I, and then, you know, if you pass, you know, Suchi walking down the street who has this, you know, software-based algorithm that says, do not record me. Yeah. And now it turns the camera off. So who trumps who? Right? Do I help the blind person safely cross the street, or avoid the pothole, or, you know, avoid physical damage?
Right.
Well, not even just that though. It's and Joel, you like hit it the nail on the head on this one. And this is the tension that I've ended up at every single time when I'm looking at this, is how much do we value anonymity? And I think that's, can we be anonymous if we're all in this easily enabled augmented reality or mixed reality? And then on top of that, what does that mean for your minority populations? Like, what if you're LGBTQI or something else in a country that isn't very accepting of it? And I'm going to use my own, you know, the motherland as an example. Like, India has a huge LGBTQI population. I think I'm missing a letter, but we'll figure that out. So that population isn't particularly supported. And if, you know, if someone just was like, yeah, I was walking around and I saw your daughter cross-dressing the other day or hanging out with a bunch of trans folks, and then outed that person, like the it's so ripe for abuse. And that's the other thing that really needs to be considered. Like, we need people who are thinking and talking about, and I thought that XRSI has been doing a good job in setting up like the initial frameworks that they'd recommend for privacy, security, and like trust and abuse. And so, Joel, I don't know if you want to talk more about that before we
actually, I want to kind of interject here, because I think there's another part of society that we're not addressing right here. When we start thinking about digital profiles and AR and XR profiles, most people go into those things not wanting to be themselves.
Right.
I mean, we've all seen Player One, all read the book. At least I hope we've all read the book. but people go into virtual reality. People go into social media with the concept that they can change who they are as a person. So we are talking about privacy and data in terms of the person representing themselves as who they are. But most people aren't going to do that. So how do we address that? How do we apply privacy and data law to that?
I mean, people are really being forced into one persona, especially when you look at like Oculus, where Facebook was like, yeah, you can have a separate account and not tie it to your Facebook. And then rolled out all their stuff about you have to have first name, last name, blah, blah, blah.
Totally true. Totally true.
Now we're tying it together. Yeah.
Joel said earlier, you know, where he's got CyberBytes folks building their own.
Right.
VR. There are no regulations. There are no rules that go with that. Here you go. Here's this thing. And we taught you how to build it because we want you to understand the technology. But what happens when there are no regulations on that technology? And kids are smart. Oh my God. They're so smart.
They're so smart. This isn't going to solve it. But one of the things we do is we put a huge emphasis because, you know, last year, the camps that we ran were really a little bit, we had a couple sections on like cybersecurity and programming and stuff. And we made it a point to hit ethics home hard, right? Oh, yeah, and we'll do the same thing when we do AI next week, right? So, you know, you were going to have 13, 18-year-old kids coming in. We are giving them just enough information to truly be dangerous and be able to go out and find it, right? So we hit ethics hard.
But I'm also pushing the responsibility that comes with that. And I know it's the same with cyber patriots. Yeah. It's the same with Girls Who Code. I'm going to teach you things. We're going to show you things that are very, very important and serious. And we expect you to take the time to look within yourself and say, am I going to use this for something bad or am I going to try to help, right?
Yeah. And like, I think it's great that, like, I applaud that you're teaching the ethics of this because needs to happen. But then we come back to the, should it only be you? You know, what if someone else is running the same type of a summer camp, which I know
ethics.
Yes. Yeah. Without emphasizing that. And then think of ourselves when we were younger. I mean, even just 10 years ago, I would make really dumb decisions. Like, you know, I wouldn't trust that.
For me, that was like 5 minutes ago.
It happens like that. So I guess, you know, one of the reasons, Keenan, that I thought we should talk about this, the three of us should talk about this, is because there is burgeoning attention in this. And Joel's been in the space a lot longer than I have. There's burgeoning attention, but we need the attention on it from an even broader coalition of people. And we need stuff to start getting pushed at the state legislative level, or even start the conversation, because we're going to be another 10 years down the road before anything happens, right? We've only just passed one biometric.
I don't know about that. We see video game companies coming out with this in full force, whether it's fitness, whether it's, you know, totally immersive into Valhalla. Okay, Valhalla is not there yet. And I'm going to retain comments on Valhalla right now. But there are games that are out there that are really pushing into this space. And you know what? The consumer population is digging it up. They love it. They love it. They love it. So how do we address that?
Yeah.
Hey.
All right.
Wow.
Guys, I know we can actually talk about this forever. And I want you guys to come back on the show because this was so entertaining, but amazing and important. And I want to thank you guys for coming on the show. I really do. This was an amazing topic, and we're definitely going to have part 2, part 3, right?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah, looking forward to it. I do appreciate the invite. I mean, I've been waiting to have these conversations. So, good. I mean, it's the industry is sort of catching up to where, you know, where I thought we should have been a while ago, right? But I mean, hey, it's commercialism, right? I mean, we've got money to make, and I'm not one, I'm certainly not advocating that, you know, I mean, companies need to make money, right? But there's a huge, we got to balance that, right?
But we have to have the ethics piece that goes into it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a huge topic. Huge topic.
Oh my God. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
For the listeners, we have lots of links and information that you can check out about all of these topics. And I just want to say this was maybe, don't tell anybody else, maybe my favorite episode of the National Blast. I'm Keenan Skelly, and I've had the amazing guests of Suchi Pahi and Joel Charlotte. And catch us next time for something fun and crazy. Bye-bye.
VArmor enables organizations to protect their data, digital assets, and themselves through a complete understanding of all applications and identities and the information relationships between them. Every application, every user, every data element. Learn more at VArmor.com. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the National Blast Podcast with Keenan Skelly. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.